You're listening to excerpts from City State, a critical forum on surveillance and social control that took place in Melbourne and Sydney, Australia last year. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner, Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. We continue.
Roger Clark specializes in the management of information and information technology. His work encompasses corporate strategy, government policy, and public advocacy, particularly in relation to privacy and data valence.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm wearing this kind of clobber for two reasons. The real reason is I'm going straight from here back to Canberra, straight into a dinner party. But there's a symbolic reason which is more important, and that is that I'm a member of that awful species called information technology consultants. And I'm going to be talking to you from that perspective today, not from the perspective of a sociologist or necessarily an activist. What I'm going to stress is things to do with, firstly, the march of technology, and specifically the march of technology in the data valence arena. I believe, and I've written a number of times in the past, that we've been hung up too much for too long on the Big Brother image, which is an image of visual surveillance. The big changes during the second half of the 20th century have had a great deal to do with data surveillance, monitoring people through the data trails they leave behind them, much more than the images that can be captured on tape or onto DVD. And I'm going to have to put my glasses on to read my notes. It's that stage of life, I'm afraid. Reverting back to about the 1950-52 period, we applied computers initially to calculate trajectories of projectiles. That didn't last long. We moved quickly to what we called for a long time data processing. It started out with mere things like payroll, but it quickly came to be the capture of data which reflected interesting events. During the first, say, 20 to 30 years, the concentration in business and government was on economic events, things with economic impact, to do with accounting, bookkeeping and the like, keeping track of how much you paid to whom if you were a government agency dispensing benefits. But that progressively changed over a period of time because the nature of events that are of interest to organisations extends beyond the mere straightforward bookkeeping and economic. And this period of technological development didn't cause what we've achieved in data surveillance, but it was combined with a series of other things that have been going on for even longer. The triumph of managerialism, if you will, rational management, horrible word, rational, I agree, highly ambiguous, but we think we know what rational management means. Distrust by organisations generally of individuals because of the increasing social distance between individuals and institutions, the increasing scale of institutions, the increasing centralisation of power in institutions. So social control has been a dominant theme amongst organisations right through the second half of the 20th century. Computing, data processing, information systems, all of these technologies came along around the same time and contributed greatly. And then, of course, through the end of the 60s through into the 90s, there was the convergence of computing with communication. These technologies came along around the same time and contributed greatly. And then, of course, through the end of the 60s through into the 90s, there was the convergence of computing with communications and both local communications and distance telecommunications. And with that, the ability to interrelate multiple sources of data. So a series of techniques that developed and became much more common. Data matching, front-end verification, profiling its several sensors became much more established, could draw on many more sources of data. And that, of course, then fed back to the demand for even more data trails to be established and for even more care to be taken in the accuracy and detail of those data trails. And that led on to automated data trails, where they ask us to establish the data trails for them rather than having to spend the money themselves. And that's things like ATMs and FPOS. And more recently, personalized mobile phones, which successfully link many of your conversations directly to you rather than merely to a socket in a wall. The net effect of all of those things has been that the economics of surveillance changed dramatically from about 1950 onwards, and it became feasible to not merely submit to monitoring the few individuals that you could afford to put agents on the track of. You could now have what we would now call digital agents working on your behalf, tracking data trails in order to find which individuals you should be most suspicious about so that you could expend your manpower on those individuals. So mass data surveillance has come to complement and feed personal data surveillance during that period. Now, central to all of this have been a bunch of technologies to do with identification, because it's all very well to try to merge data trails from many different sources, but if you can't get the right data from that data trail linked with the right data from that data trail through common identifiers or correlated identifiers, you're not going very far as a surveillance specialist. We've long had personal identifiers, things like names, our appearance, our style, but we've had for 50 years a lot of organisation-imposed identifiers, typically numbers. And of course, we've increasingly happily carried tokens which bear those identifiers and make them more readily captured. And we tend to be expected to carry personal knowledge in order to affirm or authenticate that code and our relationship to that code. So passwords, PINs and passphrases have become technologies that we have cheerfully submitted to. Now, in amongst all of this, we've got to remember that we have many, many identities. Don't get trapped in these silly nonsenses of multiple identities being suggested by some people to already be indicators of criminality. They aren't. We all have multiple identities. Lots and lots of organisations impose lots and lots of identifiers on us. That's actually a good thing. I'm a great believer in wallets full of cards. I like to have many different identifiers because it presents an opportunity to build bulwarks between the various silos of data. Of course, governments work very hard to break them down, corporations work very hard to break them down, but at least they've got to work, and that's progress. Well, beyond the idea of identities, we've got to have a new concept. Identifiers and identification are words that have been around for a long time from things like organization-imposed codes. They strike through the many identities that we have, they strike through to the entity that we are, and they're much more direct and much more risky mechanisms because they deny us the opportunity to operate in different phases of our life through different identifiers and to establish multiple identities stored in different databases. So biometrics has to be watched very carefully. The natural biometrics are the ones that are focused on. There's enormous deficiencies in all biometrics technologies. Facial recognition technology, as I'm sure will be talked about later, is one of the biggest instances of fraudulent misrepresentation that have ever been thrust upon unsuspecting or trying to be unsuspecting government agencies. But there is a discussion later on in a workshop on biometrics. And let's not forget the impending phase of imposed biometrics, because there are so many deficiencies with the small number of physical biometrics that do actually work. There will be increasing demand for chip implantation, not just in dogs' necks and prime cattle stocks' necks, but in individuals. And there are plenty of opportunities and plenty of natural paths of development that we've traced in the literature showing how that's going to develop. And don't forget, too, our social identity. Social identity in the sense of the people we associate with. All of our paths have crisscrossed. There's been lots of emails exchanged amongst lots of people in setting up this event. There are technologies in existence, and those technologies are being enhanced as we speak, and I'm involved in some of that enhancement, which is designed to apply the same kinds of things sociologists do in social network analysis in order to build social patterns and social identities of individuals. And then there's the whole location and tracking technology arena. For a long time, we've identified, bad word, we've shown that we are in a particular location by using a card at an ATM or at an FPOS, which is a fixed point in space, which is known and mapped. There's all sorts of other places like building entrances and parking lots, tollways. I came along. The world's, to the best of my knowledge, still the world's only major public thoroughfare that you cannot use anonymously. Your wonderful Melbourne City Link. So tollways is another area of fixed points where you display that you're going past this point. Taxis do it all the time, trucks do it all the time, going past traffic lights with the device sitting in the back of the vehicle declaring their current location, the current fixed point they're going past. Cellular phones, PDAs, personal digital assistants in your pocket, digital cameras indeed, satellite phones and the rest of it, declaring their location. They already do it, even when they're switched off, to the local base stations. The base stations are being multiplied in the near future so that resections can be done, so that there can be considerable confidence that that particular device is not merely in a cell, which is a couple of square miles, I don't want to end this on a negative note by suggesting that we're all doomed. There are a couple of facets here. The first is there are strict limits to surveillance. There are limitations on every one of the technologies that I've rushed past today in my 10 to 12 minutes or however many I'm stealing. There's also enormous limitations on data quality and on data capture, on the reliability of data capture, on the reliability of identities and even of identifiers, biometrics that are captured about people. Enormous difficulties in systems to actually make them work. And all of these technologies depend on very substantial infrastructures. There's a whole series of things to do with lots more towers, to do with lots more software in lots more devices, which are then interlinked across a national network. And anything that is complex suffers entropy. It runs down. It requires a great deal of care in order to make it work. With some of these, the amazing thing is that they can actually work outside the laboratory. So don't let's think for a moment that we are all totally doomed and that everybody knows everything about us. There's also ongoing dependence on loyal employees within the system of surveillance. And if you watch the way in which the FBI and the CIA started scratching and biting one another during the aftermath of September 11, they were busy blowing whistles on one another, and many of them were unhappy with the sub-professionalism of all the things that were going on around them. People within the system, moles if you like, are very much working against surveillance technologies. But beyond the incidental and accidental and surveillance technologies are bloody difficult, beyond that, there are many strategies that we can adopt as individuals, as members of organisations, to do something about all of this. There's various technologies that we can get in behind and that we can apply. Anonymity technologies, pseudonymity technologies, cryptography to protect the data that we transmit. Making a habit of using multiple identities, making sure that multiple identities remain mainstreamed and don't get marginalised to criminality, making sure that when we store things, we get into the habit of storing them in a distributed fashion. Think P2P, think Napster, and why Napster went under, about the need to minimise the number of choke points there are in the system and the number of opportunities that control freaks have got to get it. There's actions that we can take, and there's changes in philosophy and sociology that we can enter into. We've got to prick technologists' bubbles all over the place. We've got to test out their technologies and show their weaknesses. We've got to think about what technologies would have actually done to prevent the September 11 attacks. And my very quick comment to you is that there is no technology this side the door to the cockpit that could have actually have prevented those actions succeeding. So don't let's swallow this nonsense about all this technology being pumped into airports actually making any difference to what actually happened. It's absolute rubbish. We should also stress the fact that we don't actually want to live a totally risk-free existence. It would be utterly and completely boring. It would be totally against the genome that that we've all inherited. And the last thing I'd like to stress is that I get upset when I hear people talk about September 11 having changed the world. In the scheme of human death, it wasn't actually all that vast. The real changes that were brought about, and let's be clear about it, came about on the 12th of September, when the smart right wing exploited the opportunities they'd been given the previous day. Thanks very much.
That was Roger Clark discussing the use of data matching and profiling technologies. David Sutton is a policy researcher and technology theorist who looks at the modern reality of living among data phantoms.
What I'd like to do here is examine the mechanisms by which data surveillance operates and to propose a concept for thinking about them that I refer to as data phantoms. In a sense, David Lyon's already pointed towards this with his response in the previous session. I guess when most people think about surveillance, I know this is certainly the case with me, they tend to think about fixed location, constant observation devices, such as the CCTV cameras that Dean was talking about. And that sort of surveillance, at least in part, is meant to work by setting up a field of observation within which there's a possibility or perhaps even a probability that one's actions are likely to be observed and recorded by the relevant authorities. And the presumption is that if you know that that's possible or probable, you'll actually act within societal norms of behaviour. Now, modern data surveillance, by comparison, is a great deal subtler and more economical in the way that it operates. It works by recording points and acts of access to flexible and reconfigurable information networks. It records the details of those acts. The key here, I guess, is authentication, which is the basis on which access takes place. Think of the way that ATMs work. You authenticate yourself by inserting a card and by keying in a PIN number. You know, you've provided something you have and something that you know. And at that point, you've got access to your money. Now, from the perspective of the banking network itself, something quite different has happened. What you've actually done is provided all the necessary steps to enable a node on that network, the node that corresponds to that particular ATM, to be able to perform actions in the bank's structures with a level of and a set of privileges that correspond to your account, so that essentially you become effectively irrelevant, but that particular node has a capacity and a set of privileges in the data structure to modify the parts of the data structure that correspond to you and your account. Essentially, you know, everything from electronic building passes through to ATM cards and credit cards operate by you essentially authenticating and activating a point, a node on that network to perform actions in data structures with a set of appropriate privileges. And over time, these details start to collect into more solid images of you, and this is what I like to describe as data phantoms. Now, there are a number of things that can actually be done. The first is they can actually be analyzed to extract trends and patterns of behavior. They can also be cross-compared with other similar records to identify demographic trends. And this is where people start to just basically sift through the data they have on all of their customers. And finally, they can be cross-matched with other data sets using particular identifiers. The tax file number is, of course, where people do the government sector, to obtain a more detailed composite picture. And to pick on a fairly sort of prominent example here, the American people to the Waterhouse Equifax first came to prominence when people realized that it wasn't just recording credit information, but that in fact it was also intending to store medical records, which of course could be reasonably easily cross-correlate, and people to provide more composite pictures of the activities of the people it was storing data on. Now, the point here is that these data phantoms exist independently of you. They are virtual shadows, and in this sense I mean virtual in the sense of things which are incorporeal, not physical, but they are very, very real, and they have very real effects. The most obvious example here would be, going back to Equifax, you know, in simplest terms, we all know that financial institutions swap notes. So your ability to obtain financing and access to financial services is entirely based on the phantom image of you that lives in the database of that credit reporting agency. If your credit is represented there as bad, and that could be because it actually is, it could be a mistake, could be because of a misrepresentation that's been made about you by somebody. And this often happens without the data subject aware that that's actually happened, so that effectively the data phantom stands in for you without you being aware that that has taken place. Another is what's referred to as identity theft, which is so that a criminal committing a crime who's actually been apprehended by the police then gives the identifiers for another person to the police, and all of the details in the criminal record then start to accrue to somebody else's data phantom. And people find themselves in a position where, again, the phantom is standing in for them and is being interrogated when people do background checks. But of course, they have no idea, A, that it's happening, or B, that somewhere along the way, one of these data phantoms has actually picked up a criminal record. So I guess there are reasons to be concerned about, the rise of these phantom shadows, these entities that, you know, are starting to exist in data spaces surrounding us. And this sort of thing has an enormous potential, I'm sure you can all see, for discrimination. If the factors that are being used for filtering through these are picked the right, or perhaps the wrong way, the only difference between assessing credit worthiness or, you know, past criminal acts and other types of filtration is, you know, the extent to which these things are considered to be acceptable factors for filtering someone's data. Now, of course, data phantoms aren't necessarily all bad, or at least there are certainly arguments for suggesting that at the same time there are certain things that they do which, you know, have potential benefits. The flip side of this kind of data profiling is the possibility of tailoring commercial offerings to suit customers' desires. And this is the gap example from Minority Report. So, you know, like a number of people before me, I'm going to perpetuate that piece of product placement in this public place. Point is, as we move from mass production, sort of a mass production economy, to one where there's a great deal more customization and personalization of the goods and services that are actually being targeted at individual consumers, it's becoming something of commercial imperative for corporations to actually be able to obtain information that can be used for targeting the individual consumers and their desires accurately. And for anybody who reads the Financial Review, as I had to every day when I was working as a media advisor, you see ads for this kind of thing, for data mining services, and fairly spooky ones turning up in papers like that all the time at the moment. Now, the interesting thing is a lot of people are actually quite comfortable with this. I guess the thinking is that if a department store knows what it is that I like, and a department store is actually happy to give me a great big discount to purchase what I like from them, where am I hurting? In a sense, there's an economic argument for suggesting that this is a better and more efficient way of coupling desire and production within a capitalist economy. Naturally, I think that makes a lot of people quite uncomfortable because of the basis on which they're able to actually make those assessments. But I guess the point I'd make is that it's too soon to know whether we should absolutely fear data phantoms or whether we should actually accept them as some kind of useful part of electronic life that needs a series of constraints to be put on them. What is clear, though, is that they function invisibly and that most people are largely unaware that these phantoms are clustering around us. What's also clear is that there's currently relatively little that we can do about them. The point is that access to networks on this kind of a model is a privilege. What you can actually do on that network is a privilege. The capacities that attach to your data identity is a privilege. And so the information that is being collected about you is being collected as part of an exchange for that privilege and the benefits that come with it. If you want a credit card, if you want access to credit facilities, you have to provide that data as part of the exchange. And conversely, if you don't want the details of your actions to be collected, you can always opt out, but you do so at the cost of losing access to a wide array of services that we take as fundamental and normal in this informationalized society. Which is why I guess that data surveillance is not the exclusive domain. While it's not the exclusive domain of corporations, it's their preferred mode of operation. It allows them to deal only with those people who are interesting to them, in other words, those people who are prepared to pass the relevant tests and provide the relevant information to get into the data system, and to effectively exclude the rest. And I should point out that's also the reason why this sort of a model is intimately tied to attempts to provide citizenship identification. It's about a model of testing citizenship against something which allows exclusion of those who can't provide the necessary identifiers, the necessary authentication to achieve access to the system. Now, I was going to say something about the way that this breaks the traditional liberal model of privacy, but I'll skip that at this point because I suspect that I'm stealing an awful lot of time here. I guess jump to sort of talking briefly about the notion of using data protection mechanisms and data protection legislation, which in effect is what the recent amendments to the Australian Privacy Act is supposed to do. Unfortunately, what this demonstrates is, in fact, we are very much in a situation where it's very difficult to opt out of the collection of data and the creation of data phantoms. The current rules require that data collectors tell you, the data subject, what information will be kept, and they have to give you a reason for collecting it. Whether that's just for my, for our records or something like that is sort of by the by, I guess. And they have to tell you who they might give it to. Now, that protects you against misreporting, at least in as much as you have a right, if you're prepared to pay a nominal fee, to go and find out what's recorded there, and you do have a right to correct that record. But what it doesn't protect you against is unwanted acquisition of data. And a stunning example of this was, when my partner, who's a healthcare professional, and requires professional indemnity insurance to be able to practice, found that the insurer that her professional organisation recognised that she operate or obtained her indemnity through complied with the rules absolutely the letter, in that it told you exactly what it would collect and who it would give it to. But at the at the end of the list of people it would give it to, it basically said, and anybody else that we deem appropriate, or words roughly to that effect. The point is that she had no capacity to opt out at that point. She could take the insurance, which was considerably cheaper than anything else available to her, or she could basically submit to providing that kind of a data and that kind of data to these people and grow her own data phantom and know that there's no control she's got over where that data goes. And at this point, I'll wrap. I did actually have a few more comments I'd want to make, but mostly I think we can probably constrain them to questions. But the point I would make is that fundamentally, most people aren't aware that data phantoms exist, that they are completely invisible and they grow around us, and that until we start to be aware and to ask questions about the data that's being collected about us and where it goes, they will continue to proliferate, and they will continue to proliferate entirely independently of us.
I just want to pick up on that last issue about the use of data protection legislation to exercise some access and correction and rights of openness and transparency. And perhaps with you, Dean, with the CCTV that local council is using across Australia, do you see any potential to use data protection legislation to gain access to what information is being collected and to push for that openness? And also for the panel more generally, do you see any role for privacy impact assessments to be demanded as a as part of the legislation before these sort of systems are set up?
I'd have to say, in all honesty, that it's not a question I've looked into whether you could actually use. You're talking about using like freedom of information legislation to get. I very much doubt it that you could actually do that to access footage.
Two facets. I don't think it's likely that under most legislation, Victoria's I'm not quite familiar enough with, I don't think it's likely that CCTV images would satisfy the requirement that the person is identified. So I've got a suspicion that that it would be a fruitless task, but it's certainly worth investigating. I was going to ask the question, not necessarily for answer, as to whether the Victorian Surveillance Devices Act might also provide some control mechanisms here in the case of local council CCTV. And I say I have to ask the question. It's the only such Surveillance Devices Act that is a modern one and a comprehensive one in Australia. So if it doesn't, the other states are a forlorn hope.
What's happening with data collection systems which hold people's medical records and medical histories? Because I've read little bits about, for instance, workers having to submit to medical tests and checks on their medical histories when applying for jobs. And I was kind of wondering where that's at in Australia in terms of legislation and whether medical records are still held kind of, I suppose, by a kind of a government system or whether they're increasingly moving towards being held by kind of private databases.
Firstly, there are very strong moves towards establishing a framework for an electronic health record. And some of the simplistic thinkers who are working in that project, who aren't my clients, hence I can say that about them, are thinking as though there was going to be a single central record into which your all the records which are currently scattered across often significant geographical spreads would be shoveled into one place. It ain't going to happen. What is much more likely to happen is stronger associations between those physically separated storages of multiple GPs, multiple clinics, multiple hospitals, multiple path labs. They're trying to get up unique patient identification schemes. I wish them luck with that. Actually, I don't. I wish them bad luck with that. But what I think that is too difficult, but there will be some correlation amongst identifiers used in these different records in order to work towards a virtual centralised electronic health record. There's good and bad in this. There are also moves afoot, which I've been directly involved with, to try to get consent to become a much stronger component of the use of health data. Hitherto, it has been almost completely absent. There have been presumptions made, some of them quite reasonable presumptions. Healthcare workers aren't all evil. They're trying to do things and they're trying to achieve results, but they have often shortchanged the issues associated with the sensitivity of the data. And the last point about access and usage for such things as employment, there is a strong tendency towards increased use and increased access. Insurance companies are some of the nasties to worry about. On the one hand, there are increasing numbers of laws that appear to protect us, both at Commonwealth and certainly Victorian, to some extent ACT level. Unfortunately, each of those statutes is so absolutely riddled with exceptions to the simple principles of privacy protection that they essentially consolidate and authorise the many exceptions that already exist in practice. So there's good news and bad news floating around in the whole healthcare sector, but it's a very complicated issue and not one to be knocked off in a five-minute discussion.
At the recent protests outside the Maribyrnong Detention Centre, the police had their own lovely camera person and were filming not in front of the protest where we were actually near any of the fences where there might be potential criminal activities that they would be attempting to record, but were merely recording every face they could get their hands on, I presume for storage and facial recognition and analysis later, despite they were unwilling to divulge to me what they were going to use the tape for when I questioned them, and of course they now have me on tape interrogating them about what they were going to use the tape for. Do you know anything about how these sorts of video analyses are stored and whether the CCTV stuff and videos that are taken like this get stored with names attached to them?
Pattern recognition generally is one of the dead areas of artificial intelligence that's promised us a great deal since about 1950 after World War II and operations researchers moved in that direction. And we're still seeing applications for research grants that look very similar to the ones that were written in about 1950. Trust me, I get to read some of these things. And pattern recognition of faces and pattern recognition of movements in a club which suggest the commencement of violence. Sorry, fellas, it's all too hard. We just can't teach computers to do that in real time. And this facial recognition stuff is absolute bunkum. They didn't even find two. Tampa was a complete disaster, both the one at the Super Bowl and the subsequent attempt in Ybor City, which is the municipality nearby. They were absolute and complete disasters. There's ACLU reports where they've gathered quite a lot of information as a result of FOI requests. And they just didn't work.
You are listening to Dean Wilson, Roger Clark and David Sutton speaking on electronic bodies, an address to City State 2002 held at Horty Hall in Melbourne. Dean Wilson is a research fellow in the Department of Criminology at the University of Melbourne. He is currently completing the first major study of town centre closed-circuit television systems in Australia. Roger Clark specialises in the management of information and information technology. His work encompasses corporate strategy, government policy and public advocacy, particularly in relation to privacy and data valence. David Sutton is a policy researcher and technology theorist. 9/11 has dramatically altered the terrain of surveillance technologies, laws and practices. Angela Metropolis edits and writes for the Exporter website, and has written for and edited a number of other journals and magazines on the issues of border policing, migration and virtual movements.
Post-911, or was it post-Tampa, I'm not sure, it's become a real buying spree for border protection. Over $12 million for research into high-frequency surface wave radar, $275 million to enhance the over-the-horizon radar, $160 million to purchase the remote-controlled surveillance aircraft called the Global Hawk, $2 billion to buy P3C long-range surveillance craft, and that's just some of the new stuff. It doesn't include the technologies already deployed by a bloated and aggressive Coast Watch, or by the navies that patrols the Northern Oceans looking for small boats to fire warning shots over. It doesn't include the billions already spent on information systems, surveillance and biometrics in the internment camps. So if you need empirical evidence that the border is the place where surveillance happens without parallel, then you need only check the budgets. But that is not, I think, the reason why it's important to talk about border policing in the context of a discussion about surveillance. Sure, there's lots of surveillance technology being deployed at the border, but putting it like that, it makes it seem as if there are these pretty elaborate, expensive technologies, and then there is border policing, as if it were possible to understand them as distinct occurrences, separate processes brought together out of mutual convenience. My first point, however, is that border policing and surveillance are pretty much the same thing. Today, we tend to associate surveillance with high-tech gadgets, systems that are, by and large, automated and electronic. But what surveillance does is asked the question that every border guard has asked since sentries were first deployed around the encampment, the fortress and the city-state. That is, who goes there? Put another way, surveillance is interrogative. It seeks to identify the figure, the kind of boat, the type of person moving or existing within a particular mapped out space, to determine whether those bodies belong there, have a right to move into certain spaces, and not least, as a way of regulating what kinds of movement are allowed within and across those partitioned spaces. The way this happens at the border can be obvious, in one sense anyway, but there are other ways surveillance does the same thing. Think of the workplace surveillance. Yes, you can work here, move your body in this way, be a worker in this space, but you can't sit there and daydream, read a book or play games over the net. Or think of the mall. Yes, you can be a shopper here, but you can't just hang out, especially if you're a young, male, otherly complexioned, look like you're never going to spend any money and are likely to sneak into the multiplex. That kind of thing happens within every enclosure, the fixing of the movements of the body into a determined identity. At the border of the nation state, with regard to those who move without being authorised to do so, this is called the refugee determination process, a form of punishment for the most part. And surveillance happens here precisely as a means to brand people according to the strict terms of migration policy. So, surveillance presupposes a classification system. Today, much of that exists in the form of the database. But the outline of this classification system was firmly established a long time ago, as the first ramparts went up around the first cities, as the sentry towers were arranged high enough so that guards could announce that there were barbarians at the gates. This is the low-tech history of surveillance, founded on the rather crude idea that there is civilization here and barbarians out there. In other words, surveillance is founded on the versions of on versions of stranger danger, xenophobia. Today, classification systems, the categories upon which databases are built, recalls the terms of this distinction between barbarism and civilization, the foreigner and the citizen. Racial profiling is probably the clearest example of using those same categories. Racial profiling is less common in Victoria than it is in New South Wales, but on a national and international scale, this racial profiling, xenophobia, really is driving the agenda, providing what seems to be the irrefutable alibi for increasing levels of surveillance and social control. The package of so-called anti-terrorist laws in the US are not called the Patriot Act for nothing. In any case, the idea that there are barbarians at the gates endangering the civilised social fabric at some point in history begins to imply not only those out there beyond the gates of the city, but a kind of double figure emerges, existing both inside and outside the city at the same time. This inside version, once referred to as the dangerous classes, consisted mostly of immigrant workers, many of them from Ireland, who had made their way to the emerging industrial towns of England. Needless to say, many of these people were later convicts, deported from England to Australia. Anyway, that section of the working class who could not be entirely captured by the identity of the working class, those who moved through the city as an unmanageable throng. That is, those who did not move through the city as if it were only a market, where public encounters are not simply those of buying and selling, or certainly not the kind of buying and selling that the state had authorised. Put another way, these were not the good citizen workers who would take their enjoyments, their cultural, political and social differences into the privacy of their own homes, just as one might consume a commodity, that is, indifferently. For the dangerous classes, difference was also dissent, and it was also public. In any case, there are two points worth making about the emergence of this doubled figure, the barbarian both at and inside the gates of the city. The first is that it really does mark the point at which surveillance was directed inside the city limits, when it became generalised as a social norm. I think this happened well before 911, has been happening for centuries with some ebb and flow. But certainly after 911, there's really no denying it for a generation that can't recall things in terms of centuries. But there are other responses, and here,
As regards the emergence of this doubled figure, special mention shouldn't be made of the protests currently underway in Strasbourg. For those who don't already know, there's a No Border Camp being held in Strasbourg. It was chosen as the location for the No Border Camp because it focuses attention exactly on this doubled figure. Strasbourg holds the main database for the EU's border policing agencies. Post 911, post the anti-summit protests, two new databases are being built. One is being used to identify people to be targeted for deportation. The other, in order to identify protesters and bar them from going to events at which they might disturb the peace. Which brings me to the second and last thing I wanted to emphasise. The national border is the limit of your classic smaller liberal approach to surveillance. No matter how much empirical evidence there is at the border, the border policing xenophobia forms the pivot of things like surveillance, the anti-terrorist laws and such like. It sometimes seems to me that discussions of surveillance avoid this, prefer instead to approach the topic as if it's only a scandal when it touches the lives of otherwise law-abiding citizens. In other words, of Australians, or those regarded as properly Australian. I'm not sure if that's a deliberate avoidance, a calculation that only citizens are worth addressing because citizens vote, or whether it's just a blind spot formed by liberalism's strong investment in seeing itself as a civilising force, but whether it's structured by a sense that the only politics worth doing are electoral politics, or seduced by the appeal of the civilising mission, it's fairly clear to me that it reproduces the terms through which surveillance happens, ultimately gets justified. Because whether there really is such a figure as the barbarian is beside the point. This is a category formed within a database. All it takes is for the state to classify someone as a barbarian and then the worst becomes acceptable. In response to this, we could insist that we're not barbarians, that really we are civilised. Which is a move that pretty much amounts to pointing the finger at someone else because it assumes that there are still barbarians, real ones somewhere, who really do deserve all the attention. Or we can do some jamming instead. And when and if we're asked the question, who goes there, we might like to answer in such a way that shows solidarity and insist, as Ben Ho has argued elsewhere, that we are all barbarians, all of us foreigners. And that pretty much is what I wanted to say.
That was Angela Metropoulos at City State 2002, talking about surveillance in terms of the surveying of movements of bodies in and through heavily partitioned spaces. David Lyon teaches sociology at Queen's University, Ontario, Canada. He is also director of the Surveillance Project and the editor of the new e-journal Surveillance and Society, as well as author of Surveillance Society, Monitoring Everyday Life.
It was suggested that I make a few wrap-up comments as well as say one or two things about intervention. It's been a great day as far as I'm concerned, and it's great to be involved in an event like this and to be made so welcome as a stranger in your midst. A couple of things that I thought it might be worth saying about responses to September the 11th, because that's something that has woven its way through the talks and discussions of today. Many of them, it seems to me, as it seems to a number of our speakers, are deeply undemocratic and therefore dangerous, particularly for certain groups, as Paula was just commenting on in relation to Arab and Muslim profiling in particular, but also for any who would engage in any form of political dissent or questioning, even artistic questioning. And I think this is summed up best by quoting from the most impeccable source, Attorney General John Ashcroft of the United States. "To those who scare peace-loving people with phantoms of lost liberty, my message is this: your tactics only aid terrorists." I don't think I need to add to what he has to say. Some of the surveillance we've been talking about today is deeply technological. Other kinds have no technological mediation whatsoever. And I think it's important to remember that. Some of the discussions that we've had have sort of assumed that there's technological mediation, and others have made it quite clear that there need be none. People watching people may be purposeful and may have consequences for those who are watched, but there's no technological mediation. So I think it's important when we're discussing these things to consider, on the one hand, those that are mediated technologically and others that may not be. And on those technological responses, I've heard various kinds of comments and discussions today. And I think it's worth remembering two things. One, that of those technological responses to September 11th, all are limited or flawed in some significant respects. That is to say, especially with regard to the claims of preventing future terrorist attacks, it's a huge mistake to imagine that there can be any truth, and I agree with Jude, speaking the truth is tremendously important here, in that claim, that something that can somehow be prevented by the application of some technological fix. And I refer to any of those that we've been talking about morning and afternoon, biometrics, smart IDs, and so on and so forth. They are severely limited in obtaining the desired results. That is, the intended consequences are unlikely to be realized. But on the other hand, the unintended consequences are likely to be profound. And that is simply a broadening of the surveillance net and a tightening of the matrix of that surveillance net. The categorization that occurs is intensified as a result of the broadening of surveillance after September the 11th. And that broadening of the surveillance web always carries with it more risks. And it's important to remember that too, that whatever the increased protection or security, real or unreal, extensive or narrow, there will always be more risks with the application of new surveillance technologies. A couple of comments on interventions. For one thing, I do think it's a little presumptuous of me as an academic to talk about interventions, which many of you know far more about than I do. However, I do think it's important that wherever we are in our specific workplaces, organizations, local groups, to be aware of the issues in our own context. So, for example, I am a supporter of a thing at my own university, Queen's University, called a privacy audit that is just beginning this summer. And it's an audit of the whole university looking at ways in which personal data is handled. I could tell you some hair-raising stories about how personal data, particularly on students, is misused and abused within the university. But I think if we lend our support to whatever projects might be feasible for watching the watchers, as Jude put it, then we do begin to intervene where we are in our own places of work and activity. One thing that we haven't really talked about much today that it seemed to me, again, worth just mentioning briefly, and that is the role of the internet in providing resources for understanding what is going on in the surveillance sphere and for providing some means of networking with others who are in the field. There are numerous sites that it's worth going to. I mentioned computer and information professionals this morning. There are organizations such as the Electronic Privacy Information Center, Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility, many organizations that offer some kind of online resources, or Privacy International. It may have its flaky edges, but Privacy International carries some of the most useful international information on surveillance systems that is available at all on the internet. So, intervention can include intervention on the internet and using the resources that the internet has to offer. As a sociologist, I look at a whole range of interventions and responses to surveillance, from, as I say, ordinary everyday compliance through to forms of negotiation, through to forms of active resistance. And these depend on the level, the scale, the type of surveillance that is being perpetrated. The most effective kinds of intervention, however, I think are those that have some kind of knowledge base, where there's some serious investigation of what has gone on or what is going on as a background to whatever form of intervention takes place. So, for example, on a large scale, there is a new European Union study of CCTV in European cities, six European cities. It's a major project that is intended to examine the supposed effectiveness of CCTV systems, to look at the potential for facial recognition, and to raise questions about the accountability of organizations that set up CCTV in public places. Those kinds of interventions that are based on some kind of serious study, it seems to me, have a chance of being effective in their place. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge that there are ongoing ad hoc responses to surveillance in many, many contexts. One of the most moving books that I read recently is John Gilliam's study called Overseers of the Poor. And that's mainly about welfare mothers in Appalachia, in Ohio. And it documents the ways in which the huge weight of bureaucratic systems now computerized in order to try to constrain the capacities and opportunities of these women, and they usually are women on welfare, and the ways in which the creative and imaginative ways in which these women circumvent the computer systems of welfare departments and policing departments in order to do what they want to do, which is look after their children. It's a very moving piece, and I commend John Gilliam's work to you as a place where you'll find out about ordinary, everyday resistance to surveillance. So as I say, I value events like today. I think it's really important that academics and activists, practitioners, and politically involved people can be brought together with artists. I think that the Compound Eye and other artistic and dramatic responses to surveillance are tremendously important ones. Even, of course, he's now gone, information technology consultants can play a very important and valuable role in helping us understand surveillance systems that surround us. The reason why it's important that we are brought together is that, in a sense, even our meeting today is a form of intervention, a background to other kinds of intervention as we're brought together around some common themes. It's also revealed some key commitments that we have in common to human dignity and to human rights, to care for the other, to solidarity against systems that categorize and discriminate unfairly, that reinforce social divisions rather than seeking commonality and relationship. Thanks.
You've been listening to City State, a Critical Forum on Surveillance and Social Control, that took place in Melbourne and Sydney, Australia last year. Thanks to Alternative Radio Australia for these recordings. For more information on City State, visit www.citystate.org.
We're going to talk to people all night. We're going to talk to people about homelessness. We're going to talk to experts about various aspects of homelessness. We're going to talk to homeless people.
Coming live from the streets of Portland, Maine.
Everybody needs to work together because this earth of ours is all one home.
I learn a lot. Homeless people, they stick together. They look out for each other. I learn a lot about people.
The 6th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a 14-hour national town hall on homelessness and poverty in America.
When you become homeless, they actually put you in a mental, like you're mentally disabled. And I'm not mentally disabled.
The Homelessness Marathon on this radio station.
So you make a little money for somebody else's sweat.
Tomorrow night, Monday, January 27th, a forum will be held in Auburn on the U.S. versus Iraq, the big picture. The forum will address, is an American attack on Iraq justified or necessary? What will be the likely outcome of war with Iraq? Expert panelists will present a variety of perspectives and opinions. The panel will include Professor Virginia Tilley of Hobart and William Smith Colleges, Roger Hare, Auburn Citizen columnist, and Dr. Keith Wattenpah of Lemoyne College, who has recently returned from Iraq. Members of the public are invited to listen, learn, and share your concerns. And that is tomorrow night, Monday, January 27th, at 7 o'clock p.m. at the Calvary Presbyterian Church at 90 Franklin Street in Auburn. The forum will be moderated by Guy Cosentino. This program is part of an ongoing community dialogue series that was created to promote discussion and learning about the world and our country's role in it. The goal is to create a forum where different viewpoints and information from many sources, not just the government or major media outlets, can be explored in a comfortable atmosphere of civil and respectful discussion. The forum is sponsored by the Cayuga Coalition for Peace as a public service to the citizens of Cayuga County. The event is free and open to the public. Child care will be provided. Additional parking is available at the residential home across the street from the Calvary Church. For more information on the event, contact Jim Ellis at area code 315-252-6029. If you appreciate hearing this program and you're listening to us on 88.1 FM, please consider making a contribution to pay for the transmitting equipment that has made this possible. For more information on how to do that, visit the Ithaca Community Radio website at www.ithacaradio.org.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
The Rangers and deputies are hired by the rich man to catch me and hang me, my shiny black bears. Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by